Section 18 of The House Without a Key by Alda Biggers. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Section 18. A Cable from the Mainland. John Quincy awoke at 9 the following morning and slipped from under his mosquito netting, eager to face the responsibilities of a new day. On the floor near his bureau lay the letter designed to speed the parting guest. He picked it up and read it again with manifest enjoyment. When he reached the dining-room, Haku informed him that Miss Minerva and Barbara had breakfasted early and gone to the city on a shopping tour. "Look here, Haku," the boy said. "A letter came for me late last night."
"Yes," admitted Haku.
"Who delivered it?"
"Cannot say. It were on floor of hall, close by big front door."
"Who found it?"
"Kamaiku."
"Oh, yes. Kamaiku.
I tell her to put it in your sleeping room. Did Kamaiku see the person who brought it?"
"Nobody see him. Nobody on place."
"All right," John Quincy said. He spent a leisurely hour on the lanai with his pipe and the morning paper. About 10:30 he got out the roadster and drove to the police station. Hallett and Chan, he was told, were in a conference with the prosecutor. He sat down to wait, and in a few moments word came for him to join them. Entering Green's office, he saw the three men seated gloomily about the prosecutor's desk.
"Well, I guess I'm some detective," he announced.
Green looked up quickly.
"Found anything new?"
"Not precisely," John Quincy admitted. "But last night when I was walking along Kalakaua Avenue with a young woman, somebody took a couple of wild shots at me from the bushes. And when I got home I found this letter waiting." He handed the epistle to Hallett, who read it with evident disgust, then passed it on to the prosecutor.
"That doesn't get us anywhere," the captain said.
"It may get me somewhere if I'm not careful," John Quincy replied. "However, I'm rather proud of it. Sort of goes to show that my detective work is hitting home."
"Maybe," answered Hallett carelessly.
Green laid the letter on his desk.
"My advice to you," he said, "is to carry a gun. That's unofficial, of course."
"Nonsense, I'm not afraid," John Quincy told him. "I've got a pretty good idea who sent this thing."
"You have?" Green said.
"Yes, he's a friend of Captain Hallett's, Dick Kohler."
"What do you mean, he's a friend of mine?"
flared Hallett.
"Well, you certainly treated him pretty tenderly the other night."
"I knew what I was doing," said Hallett grouchily.
"I hope you did. But if he puts a bullet in me some lovely evening, I'm going to be pretty annoyed with you."
"Oh, you're in no danger," Hallett answered.
"Only a coward writes anonymous letters."
"Yes, and only a coward shoots from ambush. But that isn't saying he can't take a good aim."
Hallett picked up the letter. "I'll keep this. It may prove to be evidence."
"Surely," agreed John Quincy. "And you haven't got any too much evidence, as I see it."
"Is that so?" growled Hallett. "We've made a rather important discovery about that Corsican cigarette."
"Oh, I'm not saying Charlie isn't good," smiled John Quincy. "I was with him when he worked that out."
A uniformed man appeared at the door.
"Egan and his daughter and Captain Cope," he announced to Green. "Want to see them now, sir?"
"Send them in," ordered the prosecutor.
"I'd like to stay, if you don't mind," John Quincy suggested.
"Oh, by all means," Green answered. "We couldn't get along without you."
The policeman brought Egan to the door, and the proprietor of the Reef and Palm came into the room. His face was haggard and pale. His long siege with the authorities had begun to tell. But a stubborn light still flamed in his eyes. After him came Carlotta Egan, fresh and beautiful, and with a new air of confidence about her. Captain Cope followed, tall, haughty, a man of evident power and determination.
"This is the prosecutor, I believe," he said.
"Ah, Mr. Winterslip, I find you everywhere I go."
"You don't mind me staying?" inquired John Quincy.
"Not in the least, my boy. Our business here will take but a moment." He turned to Green.
"Just as a preliminary," he continued, "I am Captain Arthur Temple Cope, of the British Admiralty, and this gentleman," he nodded toward the proprietor of the Reef and Palm, "is my brother."
"Really?" said Green. "His name is Egan, as I understand it."
"His name is James Egan Cope," the captain replied. "He dropped the Cope many years ago for reasons that do not concern us now. I am here simply to say, sir, that you were holding my brother on the flimsiest pretext I have ever encountered in the course of my rather extensive travels. If necessary, I propose to engage the best lawyer in Honolulu and have him free by night. But I am giving you this last chance to release him and avoid a somewhat painful expose of the sort of nonsense you go in for."
John Quincy glanced at Carlotta Egan. Her eyes were shining, but not on him. They were on her uncle. Green flushed slightly.
"A good bluff, Captain, is always worth trying," he said.
"Oh, then you admit you have been bluffing," said Cope quickly.
"I was referring to your attitude, sir," Green replied.
"Oh, I see," Cope said. "I'll sit down if you don't mind. As I understand it, you have two things against old Jim here. One is that he visited Dan Winterslip on the night of the murder, and now refuses to divulge the nature of that call. The other is the stub of a Corsican cigarette which was found by the walk outside the door of Winterslip's living room."
Green shook his head.
"Only the first," he responded. "The Corsican cigarette is no longer evidenced against Egan." He leaned suddenly across his desk. "It is, my dear Captain Cope, evidence against you." Cope met his look unflinchingly.
"Really?" he remarked.
John Quincy noted a flash of startled bewilderment in Carlotta Egan's eyes.
"That's what I said," Green continued. "I'm very glad you dropped in this morning, sir. I've been wanting to talk to you. I've been told that you were heard to express a strong dislike for Dan Winterslip."
"I may have. I certainly felt it."
"Why?"
"As a midshipman on a British warship, I was familiar with Australian gossip in the 80s. Mr. Dan Winterslip had an unsavoury reputation. It was rumoured on good authority that he rifled the sea-chest of his dead captain on the Maid of Shiloh. Perhaps we're a bit squeamish, but that is the sort of thing we sailors cannot forgive. There were other quaint deeds in connection with his blackbirding activities. Yes, my dear sir, I heartily dislike Dan Winterslip, and if I haven't said so before, I say it now."
"You arrived in Honolulu a week ago," Green continued.
"At noon, Monday noon. You left the following day. Did you by any chance call on Dan Winterslip during that period?"
"I did not."
"Ah, yes. I may tell you, sir, that the Corsican cigarettes found in Egan's case were of Turkish tobacco. The stub found near the scene of Dan Winterslip's murder was of Virginia tobacco. So also, my dear Captain Cope, was the Corsican cigarette you gave our man Charlie Chan in the lobby of the Alexander Young Hotel last Sunday night."
Cope looked at Chan and smiled.
"Always the detective, eh?" he said.
"Never mind that," Green cried. "I'm asking for an explanation."
"The explanation is very simple," Cope replied. "I was about to give it to you when you launched into this silly cross-examination. The Corsican cigarette found by Dan Winterslip's door was naturally of Virginia tobacco. I never smoke any other kind."
"What?"
"There can be no question about it, sir. I dropped that cigarette there myself."
"But you just told me you didn't call on Dan Winterslip."
"That was true. I didn't. I called on Miss Minerva Winterslip of Boston, who is the guest in the house. As a matter of fact, I had tea with her last Monday at 5 o'clock. You may verify that by telephoning the lady."
Green glanced at Hallett, who glanced at the telephone, then turned angrily to John Quincy.
"Why the devil didn't she tell me that?" he demanded.
John Quincy smiled.
"I don't know, sir. Possibly because she never thought of Captain Cope in connection with the murder."
"She'd hardly be likely to," Cope said. "Miss Winterslip and I had tea in the living room, then went out and sat on a bench in the garden, chatting over old times. When I returned to the house, I was smoking a cigarette. I dropped it just outside the living-room door. Whether Miss Winterslip noted my action or not, I don't know. She probably didn't. It isn't the sort of thing one remembers. You may call her on the telephone if you wish, sir."
Again Green looked at Hallett, who shook his head.
"I'll talk with her later," announced the captain of detectives. Evidently Miss Minerva had an unpleasant interview ahead.
"At any rate," Cope continued to the prosecutor, "you had yourself disposed of the cigarette as evidence against old Jim. That leaves only the fact of his silence."
"His silence, yes,"
Green cut in, and the fact that Winterslip had been heard to express a fear of Jim Egan. Cope frowned. Had he really? He considered a moment. Well, what of it? Winterslip had good reason to fear a great many honest men. No, my dear sir, you have nothing to save my brother's silence against him, and that is not enough. I demand— Green raised his hand. Just a minute. I said you were bluffing, and I still think so. Any other assumption would be an insult to your intelligence. Surely you know enough about the law to understand that your brother's refusal to tell me his business with Winterslip, added to the fact that he was presumably the last person to see Winterslip alive, is sufficient excuse for holding him. I can hold him on those grounds. I am holding him, and, my dear Captain, I shall continue to hold him until hell freezes over. Very good, said Cope, rising. I shall engage a capable lawyer. That is, of course, your privilege, snapped Green. Good morning. Cope hesitated. He turned to Egan. It means more publicity, Jim, he said. Delay, too. More unhappiness for Carlotta here. And since everything you did was done for her. How did you know that? Asked Egan quickly. I've guessed it. I can put two and two together, Jim. Carlotta was to return with me for a bit of schooling in England. You said you had the money, but you hadn't. That was your pride again, Jim. It's got you into a lifetime of trouble. You cast about for the funds, and you remembered Winterslip. I'm beginning to see it all now. You had something on Dan Winterslip, and you went to his house that night to blackmail him, suggested Green. It wasn't a pretty thing to do, Jim, Cope went on. But you weren't doing it for yourself. Carlotta and I know you would have died first. You did it for your girl, and we both forgive you. He turned to Carlotta. Don't we, my dear? The girl's eyes were wet. She rose and kissed her father. Dear old Dad, she said. Come on, Jim, pleaded Captain Cope. Forget your pride for once. Speak up, and we'll take you home with us. I'm sure the prosecutor will keep the thing from the newspapers. We've promised him that 1,000 times, Green said. Egan lifted his head. I don't care anything about the newspapers. It's you, Arthur. You and Carrie. I didn't want you two to know. But since you've guessed and Carrie knows too, I may as well tell everything. John Quincy stood up. Mr. Egan, he said, I'll leave the room if you wish. Sit down, my boy, Egan replied. Carrie's told me of your kindness to her. Besides, you saw the check. What was that? Cried Hallett. He leaped to his feet and stood over John Quincy. I was honour bound not to tell, explained the boy gently. You don't say so, Hallett bellowed. You're a fine pair, you and that aunt of yours. 1 minute, Hallett, cut in Green. Now, Egan or Cope, whatever your name happens to be, I'm waiting to hear from you. Egan nodded. Back in the '80s I was teller in a bank in Melbourne, Australia, he said. One day a young man came to my window. Williams, or some such name he called himself. He had a green hide bag full of gold pieces, Mexican, Spanish, and English coins, some of them crusted with dirt, and he wanted to exchange them for banknotes. I made the exchange for him. He appeared several times with similar bags, and the transaction was repeated. I thought little of it at the time, though the fact that he tried to give me a large tip did rather rouse my suspicion. A year later, when I had left the bank and gone to Sydney, I heard rumours of what Dan Winterslip had done on the Maid of Shiloh. It occurred to me that Williams and Winterslip were probably the same man, but no one seemed to be prosecuting the case. The general feeling was that it was blood money anyhow, that Tom Braid had not come by it honestly himself, so I said nothing. 12 years later I came to Hawaii, and Dan Winterslip was pointed out to me. He was Williams, right enough, and he knew me too. But I'm not a blackmailer. I've been in some tight places, Arthur, but I've always played fair, so I let the matter drop. For more than 20 years nothing happened. Then a few months ago my family located me at last, and Arthur here wrote me that he was coming to Honolulu and would look me up. I'd always felt that I had not done the right thing by my girl, that she was not taking the place in the world to which she was entitled. I wanted her to visit my old mother and get a bit of English training. I wrote to Arthur, and it was arranged. But I couldn't let her go as a charity child. I couldn't admit I had failed and was unable to do anything for her. I said I'd pay her way. and I didn't have a cent. And then Braid came. It seemed providential. I might have sold my information to him, but when I talked with him, I found he had very little money, and I felt that Winterslip would beat him in the end. No, Winterslip was my man. Winterslip with his rotten wealth. I don't know just what happened. I was quite mad, I fancy. The world owed me that. I figure, just for my girl, not for me. I called Winterslip up and made an appointment for that Monday night. But somehow the standards of a lifetime— it's difficult to change. The moment I had called him, I regretted it. I tried to slip out of it. I told myself there must be some other way. Perhaps I could sell the reef and palm. Anyhow, I called him again and said I wasn't coming, but he insisted, and I went. I didn't have to tell him what I wanted. He knew. He had a check ready for me, a check for $5,000. It was Carrie's happiness, her chance. I took it and came away. But I was ashamed. I'm not trying to excuse my action. However, I don't believe I would ever have cashed it. When Carrie found it in my desk and brought it to me, I tore it up. That's all. He turned his tired eyes toward his daughter. I did it for you, Carrie, but I didn't want you to know. She went over and put her arm about his shoulder, and stood smiling down at him through her tears. "If you had told us that in the first place," said Green, "you could have saved everybody a lot of trouble, yourself included." Cope stood up. "Well, Mr. Prosecutor, there you are. You're not going to hold him now." Green rose briskly. "No, I'll arrange for his release at once." He and Egan went out together, then Hallett and Cope. John Quincy held out his hand to Carlotta Egan, for by that name he thought of her still. "I'm mighty glad for you," he said. "You'll come and see me soon?" she asked. "You'll find a very different girl, more like the one you met on the Oakland ferry." "She was very charming," John Quincy replied. "But then, she was bound to be. She had your eyes." He suddenly remembered Agatha Parker. "However, you've got your father now," he added. "You won't need me." She looked up at him and smiled. "I wonder," she said, and went out. John Quincy turned to Chan. "Well, that's that," he remarked. "Where are we now?"
"Speaking personally for myself," grinned Chan, "I am static in same place as usual. Never did have fondly feeling for Egan theory."
"But Hallett did," John Quincy answered. "A black morning for him." In the small anteroom they encountered the captain of detectives. He appeared disgruntled.
"We were just remarking," said John Quincy pleasantly, "that there goes your little old Egan theory. What have you left?"
"Oh, I've got plenty," growled Hallett.
"Yes, you have. One by one your clues have gone up in smoke. The page from the guest-book, the brooch, the torn newspaper, the Ohio wood-box, and now Egan and the Corsican cigarette. Oh, Egan isn't out of it. We may not be able to hold him, but I'm not forgetting Mr. Egan."
"Nonsense," smiled John Quincy. "I asked what you had left. A little button from a glove. Useless. The glove was destroyed long ago. A wrist-watch with an illuminated dial, and a damaged numeral, too." Chan's amber eyes narrowed.
"Essential clue," he murmured.
"Remember how I said it."
Hallett banged his fist on the table. "That's it! The wrist-watch! If the person who wore it knows anyone saw it, it's probably where we'll never find it. But we've kept it pretty dark. Perhaps he doesn't know. That's our only chance." He returned to Chan. "I've combed these islands once hunting that watch," he cried. "Now I'm going to start all over again. The jewelry stores, the pawn shops, every nook and corner. You go out, Charlie, and start the ball rolling." Chan moved with alacrity despite his weight. "I will give it one powerful push," he promised, and disappeared.
"Well, good luck," said John Quincy, moving on.
Hallett grunted. "You tell that aunt of yours I'm pretty sore," he remarked. He was not in the mood for elegance of diction.
John Quincy's opportunity to deliver the message did not come at lunch, for Miss Minerva remained with Barbara in the city. After dinner that evening he led his aunt out to sit on the bench under the how-tree. "By the way," he said, "Captain Hallett is very much annoyed with you."
"I'm very much annoyed with Captain Hallett," she replied, "so that makes us even. What's his particular grievance now?"
"He believes you knew all the time the name of the man who dropped that Corsican cigarette."
She was silent for a moment.
"Not all the time,"
she said at length. "What has happened?" John Quincy sketched briefly the events of the morning at the police station. When he had finished, he looked at her inquiringly. "In the first excitement I didn't remember, or I should have spoken," she explained. "It was several days before the thing came to me. I saw it clearly then. Arthur, Captain Cope, tossing that cigarette aside as we re-entered the house. But I said nothing about it."
"Why?"
"Well, I thought it would be a good test for the police. Let them discover it for themselves."
"That's a pretty weak explanation," remarked John Quincy severely. "You have been responsible for a lot of wasted time."
It wasn't my only reason," said Miss Minerva softly.
"Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Go on."
"Somehow I couldn't bring myself to link up that call of Captain Cope's with a murder mystery." Another silence, and suddenly, he was never dense, John Quincy understood. "He told me that you were very beautiful in the '80s," said the boy gently. "The captain, I mean. When I met him in that San Francisco club." Miss Minerva laid her own hand on the boy's. When she spoke, her voice, which he had always thought firm and sharp, trembled a little. "On this beach in my girlhood," she said, "happiness was within my grasp. I had only to reach out and take it. But somehow Boston held me back. I let my happiness slip away."
"Not too late yet," suggested John Quincy.
She shook her head. "So he tried to tell me that Monday afternoon, but there was something in his tone. I may be in Hawaii, but I'm not quite mad. Youth, John Quincy, youth doesn't return, whatever they may say out here." He pressed his hand and stood. "If your chance comes, dear boy," she added, "don't be such a fool." She moved hastily away through the garden, and John Quincy looked after her with a new affection in his eyes. Presently he saw the yellow glare of a match beyond the wire. Amos again, still loitering under his algaroba tree. John Quincy rose and strolled over to him. "Hello, Cousin Amos," he said. "When are you going to take down this fence?"
"Oh, I'll get around to it sometime," Amos answered. "By the way, I wanted to ask you, any new developments?"
"Several," John Quincy told him, "but nothing that gets us anywhere. So far as I can see, the case has blown up completely."
"Well, I've been thinking it over," Amos said. "Maybe that would be the best outcome after all. Suppose they do discover who did for Dan. It might only reveal a new scandal worse than any of the others."
"I'll take a chance on that," replied John Quincy. "For my part, I intend to see this thing through." Haku came briskly through the garden. "Cable message for Mr. John Quincy Winterslip. Boy say collect. Requests money." John Quincy followed quickly to the front door. A bored small boy awaited him. He paid the sum due and tore open the cable. It was signed by the postmaster at Des Moines, and it read, "No one named Saladin ever heard of here." John Quincy dashed to the telephone. Someone on duty at the station informed him that Chan had gone home and gave him an address on Punch Bowl Hill. He got out the roadster, and in 5 minutes more was speeding toward the city. End of section 18.